And you're listening to Brisbane Line on 4ZZZ 102.1 FM, and I'm Elliot Rifkin. Do you know dugongs are the inspiration for mermaids and a cultural keystone species for Indigenous people? Do you know much about them? Joining us is Professor Helene Marsh of the College of Science and Engineering at James Cook University in Townsville to chat about dugongs. Welcome, Helene.
Thanks very much, Elliot.
Yes, thanks so much for coming on, too, because I don't think many people realize that they don't really know much about dugongs.
Well, that's probably right. I want to say, how many of your listeners would know that the dugong's closest terrestrial relative is the elephant?
I didn't know that. I would have thought a hippopotamus.
No, elephants, actually.
Ah, why are they called a dugong?
Well, there's a Malayan word that is very close to that, and they occur in Southeast Asia. They occur in East Africa as well, but that Malayan word has stuck.
You're with the College of Science and Engineering. How does that relate to dugongs? What do they do there?
So I'm a marine conservation biologist, and a big group in that college is made up of marine biologists.
Launching a little bit into our friend the dugong, you mentioned that they also live in eastern Africa, and now we know that they also live up in the Malayan Peninsula. So where are they basically? Are they just Australia-wide, like in WA as well? What's their range?
So their range is from East Africa across to Vanuatu, with a latitude of about Brisbane, north and south of the equator. So they have an absolutely huge range that spans some 40 countries.
Are they in WA as well?
Yes, they're in WA. So they're in WA, they're from Shark Bay further north, and of course they're all along the Northern Territory coast, including the Gulf of Carpentaria. And in Queensland, they're in the Gulf of Carpentaria coast, Torres Strait, and the East Coast.
And I personally know that they do eat seagrass, which I'm not sure if seagrass is a freshwater or saltwater species, if you can correct me on that. And if so, are they in the reef?
Seagrasses are saltwater species. Dugongs don't go into freshwater. Sometimes they do go into some rivers, but only in the tidal seawater parts of rivers. And seagrasses do occur in reef environments. There are lots of dugongs in the Great Barrier Reef, World Heritage Area, and in fact the significance of the area as a feeding ground for dugongs was one of the reasons it was World Heritage listed.
How robust of a species is seagrass, and is that the primary food or the only food that dugongs eat? Are they like koalas that only eat a particular one type of food?
They're what I would call seagrass community specialists. So there are quite a lot of species of seagrass, and dugongs eat pretty well all the seagrasses in their range, except for some tough, weedy, bushy kind of seagrasses. They really like soft, delicate seagrasses because they don't have very good teeth, but they eat many different species. But also in seagrass communities, there are particularly at places like Moreton Bay and Shark Bay, at the higher latitude limits of their range, there are some invertebrates, you know, little shell-like or worms, and particularly in the winter, dugongs will dig for those as well.
In the northern hemisphere, I think it would only be in the northern hemisphere, I'm not sure, you correct me again, there's a manatee. Are the manatee the only really close relation to dugongs, and how are they different, and where do manatees live, and what's up with that?
Okay, so there are actually three different species of manatees. There are Amazonian manatees that only live in the Amazon, and they are only freshwater. And then there are West Indian manatees that extend from Florida, which is where most of the photos that people will have seen are from, down through to northern South America, like Brazil, and some other countries. And they're also in the West Indies, which is hence the name. And then there's an African manatee, which is on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean in about 21 countries in West Africa. The difference between a manatee and a dugong, the most obvious difference is that manatees have a curved tail like a beaver, whereas a dugong have a fluke tail much more like a dolphin. But I think another difference difference is a dugong is a bit like a manatee that goes to the gym. Manatees tend to be a lot fatter and more bulky animals, and dugongs are much sleeker. And so a dugong can look a bit like a cross between a plump dolphin without a dorsal fin and with a head like a walrus.
Are there any places where they both live together?
Not now. In the fossil record, there were places, but manatees have actually got better teeth than dugongs, and it looks like where they occurred together, manatees outcompeted dugongs, and so they don't overlap at all now.
Are they able to interbreed if they did?
I don't think anyone's tested that. Different species of manatee that co-occur at the mouth of the Amazon, two different species, that's the only place in the world where two species of manatee occur together, and they occasionally do interbreed.
When we talked off air, you mentioned that dugongs are known classically as a cultural keystone species. Can you tell us a little bit about how both they're related to the myth of mermaids, to seafarers, as well as in our indigenous culture?
Well, first let's talk about the mermaid myth. So dugongs are closely associated with that myth. Some people say, how could it be that an animal with a face that only its mother could love could have given rise to the mermaid myth? Well, they do have tails, a bit like mermaids, and their mammary glands are in a very similar position to human breasts. So they're probably reasons. But some other people say, golly, the sailors must have been at sea a long time if they confused them with mermaids.
Right. I guess like absence makes the heart grow fonder.
Indeed. So getting back to cultural values, they have really, really high cultural values throughout their range. For example, in southern Japan, I had, in the Ryukyu Islands, I had the privilege of going to what's called a sacred grove, where there were special places, sacred places, which were decorated with dugong skulls. And not many people are allowed to go there. So I was very lucky. In Australia, they are very, very important animals for coastal Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And they have featured in artwork going back thousands of years. In fact, in Torres Strait, it's thought that they're in Aboriginal middens going back at least 4,000 and possibly 7,000 years. So people were hunting dugongs way, way, way before the pyramids were built, for example, and now they featured in artwork, etc. So they are just very, very, very important animals to Australian Indigenous people living in the coast of Northern Australia. And their cultural values are actually higher than what we might call their provisioning values, which is their values as meat. It's very complicated. You know, the dugong myth is tied up with the origin of sacred places. There are dugong totems, and members of a group that have a dugong totem have special responsibilities to the animals, etc.
How is the population of dugongs here in Queensland? Are they holding steady, declining, or increasing?
The answer to that is it depends. For example, in Torres Strait, which is the dugong capital of the world, my long-term data shows that the population is doing well. The same is true, actually, in Moreton Bay near Brisbane and in Harvey Bay. Our long-term data shows that the populations there are holding up well, and also in the northern Great Barrier Reef. The area of greatest concern is what I call the urban coast of the Great Barrier Reef, which is from about Cooktown through to the southern boundary near Bundaberg. And there's evidence over the long term that the population is declining. There might be multiple reasons for that, but one of them is that there's been quite a lot of seagrass habitat, often due to large floods and cyclones and terrestrial runoff. So seagrass loss in that area is of great concern.
So the seagrass is affected by, you're saying, the flood. That would be fertilizer that's like runoff from farming.
Well, a lot of it actually is dirty water. Seagrass is a plant and they need light. But also sometimes when you get a series of La Nina years, for example, and there's a persistent dirty water, exacerbated devastated by floods, cyclones. You can get death of seagrasses, and then the dugong starve and they start showing up dead usually about 6 months later, usually about the end of winter. The year of the Brisbane flood, Cyclone Yasi, there was a lot of dugongs died from starvation.
Speaking of the La Nina, which we're in right now, I had also mentioned to you off here that I saw an article about an orphan dugong that had gotten beached. If someone sees a beached orphan dugong, what do they need to do? And also in that article, it made reference to it. It is so difficult to rehabilitate them and to teach them how to go back in the wild that it's almost like impossible. Can you just talk to that?
Okay, well, there's a hotline to report a stranded dugong, dead or alive, but especially live, to the Queensland Park Service or in the Great Barrier Reef region, the Marine Park Authority. And then the rangers will go and evaluate the situation. If it's an animal that's independent of its mother, so more than about 1.5 metres long, it could be rehabilitated in captivity for a few weeks, probably fed a diet of lettuce, and if it recovers, it could be released. And that would be okay. The really big challenge is very, very young calves that are totally dependent on their mums. In some cases there, because the success rate of looking after young calves and rearing them is so poor, a decision will be made to kill them humanely as the most humane outcome.
I did hear that you said that we're actually doing quite good here in Moreton Bay with our dugong population. So you mentioned off air too, there's different threats to different environments. I would have thought boat strikes was a big deal to them. What are we doing good here in Moreton Bay for them?
Okay, well, look, I think there's a couple of things that are going for dugongs in Moreton Bay. One of them is I think there's a lot of natural advantages. The really good dugong area in Moreton Bay is right in the Eastern Bay, and the oceanic water comes in there every day and keeps the environment clean, and generally the water clarity there is pretty good. And also in Brisbane, you're a bit south of the cyclone belt, so although you can get cyclones in Brisbane, you don't get them very often. You have some very good natural advantages. And then there are go-slow areas for dugongs along those eastern banks to minimise the risk of boat strike. If you put all that together, it's a better situation than many other areas.
That's good to hear, because usually it's always bad news. You know, it's nice to hear that us humans are doing something right for change.
Well, it's a combination of people doing the right thing, and there's been a lot of effort over the years to clean up the water quality in Moreton Bay, but there are natural advantages with the Moreton Bay seagrass environment being so oceanic.
What are some of the habits of dugongs, and how long do they live, and do they stress out seeing people, or are they just sort of like do-de-do-de-do-de-do, you could just swim around with me?
Okay, so how long do they live? So that was some of the early research that I did. Dugongs have a lifespan like people. They can live for more than 70 years. They only have one calf at a time, and a female has to be about, usually about 7 before she has her first calf. But the big thing is, because, you know, they mainly eat seagrass, if they don't get enough to eat, they stop breeding. So when there's a loss of habitat, not only do animals sometimes starve and die, but the animals that survive also stop breeding for a couple of years. Dugongs are very long-lived and slow-breeding.
Are they monogamous, and do they keep a family unit? Are they social?
As far as we know, the only really long-term social bond is between the mother and the calf. I suspect the dugong's social behaviour is a bit more complicated than we understand, but that's the most important unit. When they form feeding herds, like they do in Moreton Bay, they're really feeding aggregations, and individual animals, as far as we know, don't hang out together for long periods. In relation to mating, in areas where there's lots of dugongs, there can be mating herds, which is, you know, males competing for access to the female, and mating herds have certainly been seen in Moreton Bay. In areas where there are fewer animals, you'll just see an individual male mating with a female, and so some of your listeners will have probably seen seen on the internet and on the ABC website, there was some footage a couple of weeks ago of mating dugongs, just a male and a female, near Yeppoon, just single pair. And Yeppoon, which is near Rockhampton, isn't a big dugong area, so it didn't surprise me that there wasn't a mating herd there. Those animals were right in the shallows.
What does your research studies, what have you been focusing on?
Okay, well, I've done lots of different things over a long time. So my early research was about dugong life history and reproductive biology, and that was mainly based on the carcasses of dugongs caught in nets. Fortunately, that's a lot less common now. Then I've conducted very large-scale aerial surveys over huge areas over many years, and it's those surveys that are the basis for our knowing how the dugongs are doing and whether the populations are going up and down over big areas, both in Queensland, but I've also done some of that in the Northern Territory and Western Australia, but also in a couple of places overseas like Palau. And then the third area, which I've collaborated with a lot of my students, has been about satellite tracking individual animals to see how they move. And what we've shown is that some dugongs don't move much. They go in and out with the tide and move over relatively local areas. But other animals go on amazing trips. And so it's possible for a dugong to move 500 kilometres along the coast in a few days. We don't really understand why dugongs do that. We know that some animals move when the seagrass beds die, but some animals move when the seagrass is doing perfectly well. And we think that a lot of that is checking out how the seagrass is doing in other areas, or mums teaching their calves where to go and look for good sources of seagrass.
Do you have a particular project that you're thinking of doing, and do you ever look for volunteers?
I'm actually doing a lot of writing and some aerial surveys. In fact, I'm editing a book about dugong behaviour right now, today. But I've had a number of my students and postdoc, and I think one of the most exciting new areas of dugong research is the use of drones. There's a group based in Western Australia who are doing some amazing work studying dugong ecology using drones. And then there's a big group led by Janet Lanyon at the University of Queensland, who's been doing longitudinal studies on dugongs in Moreton Bay. And what she's been doing is catching individual animals and studying their genetics and also looking at their health.
You've sent me some links that I'll post on our program page for people if they want to look at your bio and some of your research studies, and also if they want to dig deeper into understanding dugongs and getting involved.
Yes, that sounds good.
Lastly, it's just a minor question. They seem like they're so placid. Are they placid or are they aggressive, or they could be both?
They can be both. So when the males compete against each other for access to a female, they have small tusks and they can cause quite pronounced scars on each other, and they can, you know, really jostle and each other for access in quite a violent sort of a way. There used to be two dugongs at Sydney Aquarium, and the male bashed the female up so much that they had to be separated. Dugongs occasionally act a bit violently against swimmers, but it's very, very rare, and it's never been, I don't know of any instances where that's happened in Australia, but sometimes lone male dugongs in particular get very habituated to swimmers and come up and they're a bit rough with them. As I said, it's extremely rare, and I think it mainly happens when there are lone dugongs.
Thanks, Elaine. Really appreciate you sharing all this with us. There's so much you don't realize you don't know until you start explaining to us.
That's a pleasure. Thank you.
And that was Elaine March of James Cook University in Townsville. We were just chatting about dugongs.